Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen.
To be mean to these nice people.
This is the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is April 27th, 2011, and we are going to move quickly to a couple of items. We're going to open a public hearing on SCR 2, and I see I have Senator Nelson here to introduce some folks on the opening remarks. Did you have anything before they begin, please?
Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We're big.
So this resolution is basically to help the Happy Canyon promote their show. If you don't know about the Happy Canyon, it's a night show for the Pendleton Roundup, and it's been in existence not quite 100 years, but pretty close to it. And it's one of the great institutions in our particular area. I started ushering at the Happy Canyon back in, I hate to tell you when, they used to pay us in silver dollars, and I got to go into the dance free. And that was the biggest thing. It's been around for a long time, but it used to be down by the old Safeway, but it's...
That really is Dayton.
That is really Dayton.
Could you help us with your name, though,
record? Oh, geez, I'm sorry about that, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29, living in Pendleton. So I'll turn it over to Jason. This is Jason Hill, and he can introduce himself, and he can give you a really good history of the purpose for this bill and what it's trying to do.
Thank you, Senator.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jason Hill. I'm from Pendleton, Oregon, with the Happy Canyon Night Show. I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Concurrent Resolution 2. Thank you for allowing us to be here. We're excited and honored. I'd like to take this time to introduce the people who have traveled here with me today. Corey Neistad, our current tickets director, longtime volunteer for the show, elected the board in 2010. And our current president, Chris Cockburn, volunteer since 1995, asked to come on the board in 2002 and elected president in 2011. When I asked if they would come to Salem and stand with me as I made this presentation to you, they said yes without hesitation. It's not because they owe me favors, it's because they are dedicated volunteers to Happy Canyon. They exemplify many cast members and families that have years and years of service to Happy Canyon. This is what Happy Canyon is. It's true spirit of community, it is generational volunteerism, and it is family tradition. I've been on the board since 2006. I'm the current show director, and like many of the people involved today, I started in the show when I was 5 years old. Over the years, I've taken for granted the level of volunteerism that it takes to make this show happen. It's always been something you just do. This is without a doubt what has kept Happy Canyon going for all of these 95 years. You cannot have an event of this size function like it does without volunteers that are willing to do whatever it takes for the show to go on. The Happy Canyon Night Show is a core evening event activities during Roundup Week in Pendleton. With this historically based storyline, the first half of the show depicts the interaction of Lewis and Clark and the white settlers with the local tribes. To the slapstick second half of the show, with most of its parts originally written in 1914, and they're still being performed today. With heavy tribal and community involvement, this show goes on every year since 1916, except during 2 years of World War II. This show goes on without fail, rain or shine, period. This makes it a true Oregon icon. And by any standard, this is unheard of for any event anywhere in the United States. I'm energized about this because as show director, I have the best seat in the house. I'm right down in front of everything, inches away and eye level with everything that happens on our set. I know how much work goes into the show and the level of ownership that the cast and crew take in their parts. The grounds crew and the lighting crew start working on the show in May. The volunteers show up for the week of Roundup using vacation time or whatever means necessary to come and work or perform for no pay other than just be part of the action. The directors work throughout the year on things that... Excuse me. The directors work throughout the year on things we'll all come together for the second week in September.
Can you hear that thing on your horse?
I'm trying to guess who just sent that to me.
I want
watching at home.
I'm sorry. Okay. Where was I? Okay. The directors work throughout the year on things that all come together for the second week in September. This is why it is so unique and so special. This is also what should be known by everyone in Oregon and celebrated. This is true spirit of the West, and I'm proud of our show, and Oregon should be proud of this as well. Happy Canyon is just a few short years away from celebrating our 100th anniversary in 2016. And my wish and the wish of everyone involved in Happy Canyon is that it keeps on track and heads into the future for many years to come. This resolution would honor the people that make this show a reality. It would recognize their labor and love, and most of all, their long-term dedication. It would recognize the longevity of our show. It would acknowledge the people that conceived the idea for the show in 1913. This achievement deserves to be honored as Oregon's official outdoor pageant Wild West show. And this time I'd like to thank Dave and Alice Nelson for all the time and effort they've put into this and for all the help they've given me. And thank you again for allowing us to be here today, and thank you for your time. And I'm sorry about my phone.
usually there's a fine with that.
I'm sure.
We'll write it off today and take it. Anybody who shows up for the rodeo and the in gambling, they should get a couple of tickets.
Yes, or not. I think that's the least tokens.
Mr. Chair, okay. you can imagine they put on the show with the tribal members, community members. There's horses, there's children. Lots of things go wrong, and they have to sort of react. So I think they're pretty much.
Lots of things go on, but it always goes off. I mean, no matter what. And we just, every year, I learn more and more about those people. Just, they'll fill in. Somebody doesn't show up. Or someone's injured. It just happens. And that's really what makes it so special.
Truly true. Yes, Co-Chair Clamp.
Thank you, Jason. Do you still fit in the trunk?
No, I do not.
No. All right, just one more question.
One more.
Do you know this man? Have you seen this man?
I've
some
been
mugshot of some kind.
Numbers on
him.
And one more question: do real men wear pink?
Wow. Yes, they do.
They do. On Tuesday, right?
They have a cancer day, breast cancer day, so they do.
They do every Thursday.
Every Thursday, yes. It's Thursday around. It's very good.
Great tradition.
Okay.
Any other questions?
Serious questions?
Oh, they don't have to be all that serious. I mean, that's a real, having attended a number of the productions, it is a real interesting show and something that we would certainly encourage everybody to take advantage of when you come to the roundup this year, the 95th anniversary.
95th, yes.
And that'll get you just, you know, kind of warmed up enough so that you'll be enthusiastic for coming back for the 100th anniversary, mm-hmm. which we expect the Happy Canyon pageant to equal the or exceed the production that the Roundup did for its 100th anniversary. So, Chair? No?
Okay. Nothing.
I'm ready to vote.
With that, we'll close the public hearing on SCR2 and open a work session on SCR2.
Is there? Yes.
I was just curious, Mr. Chair, that I'm going to get an explanation here, I guess, in the book of why they call it Happy Canyon, because I know why they call it Happy Camp in California. It's because of the opium that was used back in the old days.
It's on page 11.
Page 11?
Yes. We tried.
We tried that?
A couple of years ago to acquaint some members of the thing why it might be, and we had a bottle of that Pendleton Roundup for all of the members of the Water Committee at that time. So, you know, that maybe would give you a place to start your search.
Let me see. Mr. Chair, it might be where Senator Nelson, remember last session he had his hemp bill, hemp growing bill?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Maybe he's gotten mine for his acreage.
Now we're getting it.
Going way down.
I'm still trying to become an actor so you get back in the dance.
I may have to make a phone call. You guys keep talking.
Okay.
You
ready for a motion?
We're going to open the work session on SCR2, and I'm ready for a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move SCR2 be adopted.
Co-Chair Clem moves SCR2 be adopted. And go to the floor with the due pass.
Did I say the same? Sorry, be adopted, due pass. Be adopted, due pass.
Never mind.
Okay. Is there other discussion? Would you call the roll, please?
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Esquivel?
Aye.
Representative Conklin?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Cowan?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Clem?
Aye.
Co-Chair Jensen?
Aye. Having received the Constitution majority, SCR2 is adopted and sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for being here. We were delighted to be able to offer a little help, and we'll work at it. Not real sure we can do it, but we'll work at it and try to make sure we're still in session when the Rose Parade takes place, so that y'all can come down to the, bring the girls down to the Capitol.
I wanted to have them today, but the school trumped me.
Yeah, I understand.
That happens.
We'd support that.
Thank you.
The chair will carry on that. Okay, with that, we are then going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 946A. We have Senator Nelson to introduce that bill for us.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from Pendleton. This bill is to do away with a thing called the Grains Commission, and don't get it confused.
Island bent something.
There is a commission on grass seed, but it's there are other commissions to take care of, and that's basically the context of this bill is that the Grains Commission really does the same functions as the Oregon Wheat League and the Oregon Wheat Commission. And so it's just an extra commission out there, and what we're trying to do is to streamline. And on the bent grass, that's the same issue there. They have another commission that will look after their interests. So, in short, that's really the bill. And I know there's some folks in the back that can testify to greater detail if you're interested in it.
Thank you, Senator. Is there any questions for Senator Nelson? Thanks very much, David. We appreciate it. And with that, we're going to recess the public hearing on Senate Bill 946A, and we're going to open an informational meeting on the sudden oak death. And we have Katie Koba and Doug Derrick. Katie Koba, Director of Agriculture, and Doug Derrick, the state forester, and we would make note, if you please, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, that this is Pendleton Day, apparently, because Katie goes back to the Pendleton Roundup, was the Roundup Queen back
two years ago.
There's a tribe of Indians in South America that have a numbering system that goes 1, 2, and more than two.
More than two.
And it's more than two. And
but they're a handsome bunch, aren't they?
Yes.
From Pendleton.
They are indeed.
Yes.
Yeah. I love those Pendleton Cowboys.
With that, whoever is leading off, please.
Very good. I will.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Jensen, Co-Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Doug Decker, Oregon State Forester. Glad to be here this afternoon to visit with you about sudden oak death. The purpose of our visit today is to give you a brief update on the status of sudden oak death outbreak on the South Coast, the joint efforts between our agencies, other agencies, and landowners to better understand and contain the outbreak, and then to sketch some of the funding and program strategy crossroads that we find ourselves at today. Providing you a handout that has some maps that I'll walk you through here in a minute, as well as some background information on sudden oak death. My role is really to characterize the outbreak and our collective response. First, for background, you'll remember that we first discovered this non-native invasive plant disease about 10 years ago in Curry County near Brookings. If you look at that, the first color map on page 2, the first discovery of sudden oak death was just to the northwest of Brookings. You can see some of those green stars there in that general vicinity. We knew the name of the disease. We call it sudden oak death. We also knew its method of spread from the California experience that they'd had with it. It is basically it's an invasive water-based mold that reproduces by means of spores, and it spreads on the wind, and it's particularly mobile and intense during rainfall, during wet weather, particularly during extended periods of wet weather, which we have a lot of in this area. The first infestations that we found were small and involved about 5 sites that totaled some 36 acres. Since then, there's been a multi-agency group that's formed, including our two agencies, the Forest Service, the BLM, working with OSU as well, and we've launched an eradication program that we know has significantly reduced the spread of the disease, and we've been able to better monitor its progress. Today, we know of about 460 total sites. Looking at the again at this map on page 2, the backbone of the effort really has been to establish a quarantine effort that today includes about 162 square miles of the broader, about 1,900 square miles of Curry County, and it puts everyone on notice inside that area about the presence of sudden oak death. And then we've provided technical expertise to both track the spread as well as, more importantly, to work with landowners to eradicate the disease wherever we find it. You can see, again, on this page, too, the kind of the golden color areas that indicate where we've actually gone in and treated the host site, removed those host tree species, and focused on those areas. Absent the energy that we collectively, working with landowners as well, have put in here, we're confident that the spread would have encompassed well out into the ballooned well out into the quarantine area. So we feel like we've been effective at slowing the spread of the disease. The basic approach now, when we find it at an infected site, we find the specific tree or trees as well as the other host species that will hold the spore. We create about a 300-foot buffer around that. And then we cut and burn those affected trees, both those ones that are showing signs as well as the other host species. It's called sudden oak death because the disease, it appears suddenly. The tree can look like it's healthy, and then it suddenly dies. It may host, it may have the spores in it for, you know, for a longer time or a shorter time period, but the bottom line is, you know, we need to remove, create that buffer, and then we basically cut the tree or those trees and pile them and burn them. And the key here is to try to keep short the time between the detection and then the treatment to limit the disease's ability to spread. Also looking at page 2 here, you can see the pink dots here that show the infected trees from 2011 in the area of Cape Forello, just to the north and west of Brookings. And the infestation appears to be kind of moving in that direction, moving with the prevailing winds as well. So if we look at over on page 3, just to kind of look at some of the you know, what can we learn from these two maps? On the left, we're looking at a map of ownership. You can see that the cream color being non-industrial private landowners, the dark green to the far east of the quarantine area being U.S. Forest Service ownership. So it helps you to understand there's a diversity of forest lands there. The lands that have been most affected, as you can see, are lands that are industrial forest lands. They're kind of in the middle of the quarantine area. Over on the right-hand side, the high color yellow and red is the result of some modeling that we've done together that shows the risk of spread and the likelihood that all that area inside the quarantine area, and more importantly, the areas outside the quarantine area as well, are also sites where we feel there is a high risk for spread of this disease. So we have to keep our eye on the ball here, recognizing that we've got the quarantine area that's affected, but also the potential for spread. I guess it's important for Oregon to get a handle on sudden oak death for a couple of reasons. First, the dead trees that are left behind standing represent a fall hazard for people and improvements. And then, of course, the accumulated fuel loading as the trees die, fall down, the branches, dead branches and dead trees can also feed the spread of wildfire and promote wildfire moving through the area. The second is that as the disease spreads and if the quarantine area increases, there's a strong potential for increasing costs both to the nursery industry in this area as well as to the forest product sector. It's possible that importers could refuse or require treatment of other species that are exported out of this area, including Douglas fir, hemlock, and other commercial species. So in terms of the recent developments, last year we did see a sharp increase in the infestation, the new sites compared to previous years, the majority of them appearing on non-industrial forest lands, where treatments are costly and technically challenging. Again, the largest expansion is in that area to the northwest of Brookings. We think that the expansion there is likely the result of the increased wet weather that we've had, as well as the lag time between identification and treatment. So I guess the good news is that the new outbreaks remain inside the initial quarantine area. I think the challenging news is that we're now at the limit of our funding and our technical capability to really get after this disease. So there's a group, the Sudden Oak Death Task Force, that's been considering these limitations, looking at a bunch of different options to get after this, and Director Koba is going to lead us through an exploration of what those options are.
Can I ask a question?
Please.
I'm just curious, when you refer to quarantine, now that brings some public health thoughts to my mind. Does that give you then the authority that if a tree is found infected that you can require its removal? Is that what you mean by a quarantine area?
Essentially, yes. And so maybe Katie could talk about the quarantine rules that are implemented by the Department of Ag.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair and members, Katie Koba, Director of the Department of Agriculture. The quarantine authority is through the Department of Agriculture, so we're actually the ones who set the quarantine boundaries, and basically we have that authority through control of pests and diseases for anything that could affect natural resources in the state of Oregon. So we also set quarantine areas to deal with other pests and diseases in Oregon, and that was the authority that was used to establish this quarantine area. Product that, so Douglas fir, other forest products or nursery products that are produced within the quarantined area have a very strict regimen they have to go through before they can be exported out of the state of Oregon. So that's why you want to set quarantine boundaries where you think the disease is, but you don't want to set them too large because it does impact commerce. We also see impacts to the nursery industry, however, throughout the state because of concerns from other states about product coming from Oregon. Having sudden oak death in the wild in Oregon has put our nursery industry in kind of a spotlight, and we do very extensive testing and work with our nursery industry in order to ship product out of the state of Oregon to other states. So it is a challenge from the commerce side. So I was going to speak a little bit to the challenges that we're facing right now with this disease and the ongoing kind of where we go from here. We are clearly at a crossroads. And the basis of that crossroads is kind of twofold. Number one, as we've learned more about the disease, I think there is unfortunately an admittance, if you will, amongst the experts that we are no longer in eradication mode. We don't believe that we can eradicate sudden oak death from the wild in Oregon now. unless we got a whole boatload of money. So we've shifted our thinking to try to initially maintain the disease in the quarantine area. That's been our goal, and frankly the goal through the current biennium. But looking ahead and the resources that are currently allocated to the Department of Forestry, we are at a crossroads in that we cannot maintain what we've currently been doing in terms of treatment. So the task force that's made up of individuals from forestry, from the Department of Ag, U.S. Forest Service, BLM, and OSU has come together recently to kind of outline a list of options to consider given the fact that the funding is really much less than what we're currently working with. During this current biennium, forestry was successful in getting some federal ARRA dollars to use for eradication work. Clearly that money is going away. There are still federal matching dollars available. We are currently not able to access all of those federal funds because we don't have enough state match provided now. So what I'm going to try to do is give you kind of a picture on the funding side of where we're at as simply as I can, and then talk a little bit about, given where we're currently at with funding, what we're looking at in terms of options. So the current, if we were to continue, our best estimate, if we were to continue the current work that we are now doing in the quarantine area into the 11-13 biennium, it would take about $3.3 million in state general funds to match federal funds available of $1.4 million. We're nowhere near that. In the governor's balanced budget is providing the Department of Forestry $400,000 for the biennium. And so we could match $400,000 of federal funds, but you can see that we are leaving federal money on the table to the tune of about $1 million. With the current numbers that the governor has provided in his budget. If we were to access the full amount of federal funds that are available, i.e. provide enough state dollars to match the maximum federal dollars, we would need another $1 million for the 11-13 biennium. So you can see that even if resources were found to maximize the federal match, we're still at a reduced rate in terms of the current work that we're doing on the ground in Curry County. Of course, we support the governor's balanced budget, and so the team was basically asked to come together and say, you know, with the state resources that are available and assuming you can match the federal resources, what would we actually do on the ground? What would be our priority focus and what would we not be doing on the ground? So there were a number of options that were looked at by the team. Option number one was to stop treatments altogether on private lands. As Doug had mentioned, the spread, the direction that it's moving is moving more and more onto private lands. That actually becomes more of a challenge in terms of working with the wide variety of private landowners that are out there. Some of them are absentee landowners, trying to identify them and work with them to actually eradicate the infected product on their lands is a challenge. So that was option one, number one. That one was viewed as not being a good idea because we're underway with current treatments, and that would mean just stopping current treatments, leaving, you know, partially burned or infected material on their property that may have already been cut down. So that option was set aside. Option two was continue business as usual until the money runs out. Just work and with what we're doing, and the money would run out sometime in the biennium, and then we'd stop all work altogether in the area. Option three was look at aerially applying fungicides to control the disease. That has been tested a little bit with the current work that we've been doing and some research into how best to tackle this disease. The efficacy of aerial applications was not all that great, and there are clearly concerns with people that live in their area anytime you're looking at aerially applying any kind of product. The fourth option was to really focus on kind of the boundary and the direction that the disease is going and just focus on treating sites as they get close to that boundary and try to establish a hardline boundary. And then finally, the fifth option, which is the group that is recommending, is really treat sites in priority orders to try to slow the disease spread as best as we can. So that's identifying, you know, when you have a site that pops up away from where the core is, go after that site. Look at the leading edges and try to slow the disease that way. And then finish the work that we've been doing on the treatment sites. I think what we wanted to really share with you today is, based on current resources and what we know about this disease, we're really at a crossroads. We unless something different happens, we're greatly shifting what the priority has been in terms of aggressive trying to control the disease to recognizing that it's going to continue to spread. We want to try to prioritize where we focus our efforts, but we're not going to be able to do much more than slowing the spread of the disease.
Mr. Chair.
And we have technical experts in the room that can speak to this in much greater detail than either Doug or I can. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm no technical expert.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I didn't even know what sudden oak disease was until I had the honor and pleasure of sitting on the Water Committee with Chair Jensen, gently taking me through all these things, and now he's still here trying to gently calm my nerves. And he wisely said the other day, repetition is the parent of learning. But you know what, Mr. Chair, we aren't learning. It's the fifth session now. We see these dots expanding on these maps, and there is a solution. And you know what? If we just log within our own rules in this state, we would have millions of more dollars. If we just developed more water, irrigate more crops, more food processing, more jobs, more revenue, this is a direct connection to everything I and my friend over here, the chair, have been talking about since I've been here, and him before I got here, and others long before that. There's a direct connection between dealing with this and doing those things that we're not doing. And it's insulting to you, Katie. You've been here fighting this because you sit here and plead for more money. And we've got a new director here every session, and it falls on deaf ears. And it's a small group of people in this body that get in the way of it. And I don't, Mr. Chair, I wasn't going to say anything. I'm so disgusted, but I couldn't help chiming in. And we're not doing enough to help you. But you know what? The money's out there growing in the forest, running in the rivers. All we have to do is pick it up, and we're not doing it. But thank you for your efforts.
Representative Co-Chair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. When you've been in front of this committee in the past and asked for funds, do you recall ever not getting them? E-Board, for example, an appropriation during the February session. Do you ever recall being rejected for money for this problem by this committee and or other committees?
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, I think fortunately we have been successful at getting resources for the program. You know, as well as we know, that we support the governor's balanced budget. Our job today is not to ask you for money, it's to lay out where we're going. We know there are concerns, and there are serious concerns from the forestry industry in this state, and I'm sure the nursery industry would share those concerns. Even though there's not direct impact to nursery, there is a ripple effect clearly on our nursery industry. So we're trying to lay out what's happening right now.
A few more questions. I just want on the record that this legislature has been responsive to this problem, very responsive from this committee specifically, repeatedly. Now, second, let's talk about where the real problem lies with this particular issue from not a revenue, how to pay for dealing with it. Let's talk about who isn't treating theirs at all and letting it come up into our state with their fornication, Californication. So just everybody can share in it.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Co-Chair, you remember our briefings from in the past very well, don't you?
Yeah. I hate California.
So Humboldt County in California, which is not on the Oregon border, it's a couple counties removed, experienced, and I don't remember the dates in terms of when they first saw their outbreak. They've been not nearly as aggressive as the state of Oregon has in trying to control the spread of this disease. It's been devastating to their tan oak population. I have heard Doug and his folks know better than I that a number of their horrible fires that they've had in that area have been because of dead trees that have been killed by sudden oak death. The county immediately to our south, which I believe is Marin County, help me, Dan.
Del Norte County,
immediately to our south, has been a partner with us and is trying to provide a shield from California into Oregon. We don't know exactly how the spores spread, but, you know, you've heard a little bit. So how much of the Humboldt County spores are the ones that are ending up in Oregon? I think we don't know that exactly. I think people can guess. There are experts out there. I think we are beyond the eradication phase, and we're really struggling with where we go next.
And one last follow-up. What... Remind me what happened in the lawsuit that the, I think, Oregon Nurseries, Association of Nurseries for South Carolina had to sue them to stop banning our nursery products. But then I heard there was like a federal rule that was going to do the same exact thing. Could you tell us about that? This is a big problem.
Mr. Co-Chair, yes, from the nursery standpoint, as I had mentioned, we, the Department of Agriculture, gets funding through USDA to do the sod testing in our nursery program, and we basically go out and inspect host species of nursery products before they can leave our state, provide a clean bill of health, and supposedly other states should respect our inspection and accept that product. South Carolina was a state that wasn't willing to accept our inspections and actually prohibited an Oregon nursery product from entering that state. The Oregon Association of Nurseries sued South Carolina and won, forcing South Carolina to accept our product. But since then, APHIS has been working with all of the states to try to find an acceptable approach, because there are more states than just South Carolina that have concerns about our nursery products. So what was recently set up for this growing year is a pre-notification system whereby Oregon nurseries that are shipping certain variety of product to other states need to pre-notify those states that that product is coming. The intent behind that is to, in case there is a product that comes up positive, in South Carolina as an example, they have an easy trace back mechanism to know how much product they had received, where it might have gone, and they can go gather that product up and destroy it, which is what we've had to do in a number of situations. This is the first year that notification system is in place. The concern from the Oregon Association of Nurseries would be that it would be used as a tool to reject product out of Oregon. So we're watching very closely and have expressed our concerns to USDA APHIS early in the season. Haven't heard of issues yet, but we're watching very closely.
Co-Vice Chair Collin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The northern section of California, I'm not sure, I don't know that much about their industry. Does it include the nursery industry in that general area?
Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, not very much nursery products that are grown in that part of California.
Okay, so they're not experiencing the same problems of shipping nursery products that Oregon is.
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, the three states that are kind of the target on the nursery side are Washington, Oregon, and California. So because California has sudden oak death in the wild in their state, they have the same challenges with shipping nursery product that we do. And that's somewhat been a benefit to us, you know, when you have the country of California working the same issue as you do, Washington and Oregon, that helps. But needless to say, we still have to, they have to do pre-notification for shipments as well.
I think they have the Bay Area as part of their quarantine area. Last time, they can sell into the Bay Area all their stuff. We don't have a population center like there to...
That's correct. It's shipment out of state. So if you have more of your product that stays in state, you don't need to go through those steps.
Okay. So I assume that there's a follow-up. I'm sorry. Assume that there's a cost to your agency of doing the certification for nursery products. Is that included in these sort of overall costs of what we're talking about in terms of controlling it, or is that an extra cost to the agency?
Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, the nursery side of it is the nursery inspections that we do are all paid by the industry. So they pay us to come in and do those inspections, and we have also been successful at getting some federal funds to help us fund the work that we do on the nursery side. The numbers that we're talking about here today are solely on the work that's being done in Curry County.
One last follow-up.
Hello.
And then could you help me understand those costs, the $3 million that we're short, what we do for that amount of money, what would that pay for? And part of where my thought process is going is I'm trying to figure out the ownership. I see it's mixed in this quarantine area, and I was wondering with the quarantine if then the owners of the land where it's found, I guess, are required to do to foot the bill for the removal and burning of the trees. That's where my brain is wandering around.
So, Mr. Co-Chair, Madam Co-Chair, we're going to get someone who actually knows the answer to that question, Dan Hilburn. Let him introduce himself. And
for the record, Dan Hilburn with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Madam Co-Chair, the answer to your question is that at this point, up till now, all the eradication work has been paid for by the agencies. So the landowners have not been required to do any of the work themselves. And some of them have chosen to do the work, and they've been reimbursed through forestry. The industrial timber land down there, South Coast in particular, has done a lot of preemptive tan oak removal on their own property and their own dime. And the federal land, both BLM and Forest Service, have done that also.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. One is, I missed the first part of the information. What species, is it just oak that this gets into, or is it Douglas fir, is it white fir, spruce, what is it?
Co-Chair and Representative Esquivel, tan oak is the species that is driving the epidemic in Curry County, but there's a list of more than 100 plants that this thing will infect. So tan oak is the one that's down there, but also California black oak, and there's several other oak species that are susceptible.
So it's predominantly in oak trees?
Yes.
Okay, that's the follow-up?
Follow-up.
How are we currently fighting this? Because obviously we're losing. So if we don't understand how it spreads, how can we fight something we don't understand?
Co-Chair and Representative Esquivel, excellent question. I think what's important here is to understand is this disease was new to science just a decade ago. Nobody even knew that it existed. So we're making this up as we go. We really didn't have a playbook when we started. We've learned a lot along the way, and it's a shame we can't go back to 2001 and start over, because I think we'd have a real chance at eradicating it. But we're using the best expertise we had at the time. We started out with small buffers, and they weren't big enough, and we didn't know that, so we've learned it. No one else in the world has ever been able to eradicate a forest disease. So the fact that we haven't done it is not all that surprising. We gave it our best shot. We took a big swing at it, and we have slowed it down a great deal compared to other places that haven't taken a shot at it. So it isn't that we failed. It's just that we weren't able to eradicate it from the wild.
Here you go.
Yeah. Follow up.
Okay, thank you. I mean, do you have to have like a 100-foot, 200-foot buffer zone around this? And if so, why haven't we tried to contain that by allowing people to log in there, clear-cut a 200-foot buffer zone around this area? And I know it's miles. I understand that. but see if you could work out something with people on the forest industry to take those logs, process those logs, and have a buffer zone around this to stop it. Because if we don't, we're going to have a lot more trouble in the future, because I've been to several seminars on invasive species, and this is just one of many.
Another good question, and this is one that all the agencies, I think, have struggled with. There's a problem with no markets for tan oak in that area. So there's the price of tan oak is so low that nobody wants to log it. So if we did have a market, if there was some way that you could make money on tan oak, then there would definitely be a good thing that you could do is take out the tan oak ahead of the disease.
That isn't what I meant. I meant you have to have good trees around this area that you can log, like Douglas fir, spruce, white fir, species of that nature that are merchantable timber, softwoods, because you're talking about a hardwood, that we could create some sort of a buffer zone around this by working with those people and selling the logs in order to save, to isolate this, because obviously we're not sure how to take care of this. And if it's a buffer zone that's been working, why don't we try that now?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, I think that would certainly be one option, but the cost would be much greater than what the resources that we've been putting into this, if you expected the government to pay for establishing those buffers. I think that's a pretty blunt statement in terms of where we're at.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Well,
no, I wouldn't want the government to do it. I'd want local logging organizations, logging crews, take those into a mill, process them and sell them as a camp run, and process the logs around the buffer zone before they ever get contaminated. And it's not necessarily oak, but I'm talking about the merchantable timber.
Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel.
Couldn't cost us much of anything.
Certainly that option is there for some landowners. I think one of the complexities here is particularly over toward the northwest, is that there are many, many different landowners who have a lot of different objectives and have a lot of their, you know, there's a diversity of resources that they can bring to the table to allow them to do just that. Certainly the Forest Practices Act, would permit them to be able to do harvest operations to address this. I think, the underlying condition of is the market there for folks, and is there some type of, financial incentive or cost recovery that can help them make that a viable economic proposition while also trying to get ahead of this thing? That's the challenge.
And I might share, Mr. Chair, Representative Esquivel, we had one situation where a landowner would not cooperate, felt that nature needed to run its course. And if his trees were going to die, his trees were going to die, we actually had to go to court and get a court order to go up and clean those trees. So you can imagine the time and effort to go through that process, mm-hmm. just for a small situation that we had.
Send him a bill for now.
Representative Downs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. At the last part of your written testimony here, it seems like you're suggesting that Douglas fir could be a host species, meaning they're not directly impacted perhaps by the sudden oath deck, but they could be a carrier of it. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, that's exactly right.
Okay, so if, follow up then, if I'm a landowner, or if, for instance, we have state forest lands that somehow now are within an expanded quarantine area, how can we treat timber that would be cut to ensure that it's not carrying this bacteria? Is there a plan for that?
Co-Chair and Representative Johnson, good question. There are provisions in the quarantine for logging non-hosts, and Douglas fir is not a boll host, so it doesn't die from sudden oak death. What we found is that if you have a young Douglas fir tree under a tan oak and the spores coming down from above, it'll infect the needles of the young tan oak. But we don't have a problem with mature Douglas fir trees. So logging in this area continues, but you're not allowed to take any of the branches or needles or anything. You have to clean the logs, and the trucks also have to, the mud and any debris has to be left behind so that you're not moving the disease.
So that can practically be accomplished. Again, it seems to me like it could be difficult to quantify that, but
it's an extra hassle for logging in the area.
Sure.
And I think that's a good argument for keeping the quarantine area small and slowing the spread. Otherwise, more and more people are going to be affected by that.
Well, I guess my concern would be as we talk about export of timber and so forth to other destinations, whether they be Asia, wherever, could potentially be less interested in taking our already too diminished forest products because of the threat of this. So the ramifications could be huge, I guess. So, thanks.
If I may. Kind of starting, just following Representative Johnson's thought on this. The fir tree is not going to be killed by sudden oak death. Is that
that's
what
correct?
You're telling us.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But being it's kind of like tuberculosis. Some people can have tuberculosis, and it's not a fatal thing, but they can be a carrier as such. And wherever they go and make contact with someone or something else, can spread the disease. And we're saying kind of then the same thing as far as a fir tree, Douglas fir tree, now I assume that this will be mostly in the bark of the tree, or you said in the needles.
Needles and branches.
The bark, so that if we have a mill in the area where it's processed into lumber as such, risk of spread is zero. Or
Co-chair, you're correct. The only mill in this is South Coast in Brookings, which has been closed now for market reasons, not because of sudden oak death. But you're right. Once you make it into lumber, provided you don't have any of the bark, then it's fine.
Yeah. Does sudden oak death appear anywhere else in the universe?
Very perceptive question. We don't know where the native range of sudden oak death is. We still don't know that. It's a mystery.
Some mutation of something that led to it?
I would guess that it's an obscure fungus in Asia or somewhere in Europe, and it's not a problem. We're in its home range, so who knows? We haven't found it.
Which would seem to be a fairly legitimate question for Department of Forestry at Oregon State or wherever to find out where this thing originates from. You say that it'll have some effect in the nursery industry?
I think I'll let Dan kind of explain. There are nursery products that are hosts as well. So when we ship nursery products, the concern is...
So it'd be host to oak, not to fatal to the nursery products unless it was an oak tree.
Yeah, unfortunately, some of the common nursery plants that you are aware of, like rhododendron, are host for this. Even though it doesn't kill them, they can be carriers.
Okay. And spread, therefore, throughout the universe.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shoffman.
Thank you. I'm grateful what Chair Clinton pointed out. We've given you guys some money. That is good. It's not enough, obviously, and I'm certainly not blaming this committee. This committee wants to help you. This committee wants to cut timber in this state and develop water. And some of us want to mine aggregate. God bless that industry, too. But you know what? I'm just going to make a prediction here. And it's a sad one, because it's the fifth time session I've been here talking about this, and there weren't near as many dots in 2003 as there are now. And you've made it very clear. It's a math question. You don't have the money. And I'm going to say it again. I'm sorry. We're not doing the things to get you the money to solve this problem. We're not. That's a fact, too. And it's just very frustrating for me to sit here and listen to another presentation about this problem and all the bad things about it and how it makes our nursery products worthless if it's discovered, and we're not doing the things to get you the resources to solve the problem, period. We're helping you. You've got money, but we all know, Katie, you pointed it out, it's not enough. And once again, I'll shut up, Mr. Chair, but we're not doing the things in this building to get these good people the resources they need to deal with this problem. And this quarantine, this we're going to be off the page. There's going to be dots all over the place 5 sessions from now, unless we do the things to get you the money to solve this problem. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the presentation.
Thank you, Representative, and I appreciate the representation too. I also appreciate the fact that the agency was, and that the governor's and the governor's staff were, did make the contribution to the governor's balanced budget to include some resources there. I sometimes wonder, I have to admit, in terms of where we spend money, that if it isn't enough to really do the job, if we wouldn't in fact be better off not to spend any of the money and go ahead, as your one farmer or tree owner was saying, let nature do its thing. I'm not inclined to take that particular approach. We will be looking for any resources we can find anywhere to be an infusion into this program. And I think I'm right in saying that the federal government has been at least a reasonably good partner in taking care of the problem on federal land, or trying to take care of the problem on federal land. Do we have any dots anywhere that we can point to on a map to see what's going on federal land, where we wind up in? It's a generic question. You don't have to GIS it.
Mr. Chair, we know that there have been infestations on federal land, and my understanding is when they're on federal land, they've been very aggressive at going out and dealing with those. Sure. Looks like on this deeper map, as an example, this infestation over to the far right is on federal land.
Okay. We have our land and our jurisdiction to be responsible for, and sometimes we run into these things, and the big brother partner doesn't participate as well as they might. In this case, they seem to be participating, which is a big plus for us in trying to get control over it, and a big argument, I think, for us to try to find some more resources in this session to beef up what we're doing, with it too. And I don't know how much or what is possible at this particular point, but the reason for asking you to make the presentation to this committee is there are a couple of us on this committee that do sit on another committee that might have some influence in that area. And while I realize, Co-Chair Clem, that this is for you not a new topic, and for Representative Schaffler it's not a new topic, But it is a topic, I think, that at least this co-chair felt that it was important that everybody on this committee have at least an introductory 101 on this, because it looks like we're going to be fighting this battle on a pretty long-term scale. And if every time we slip behind a little bit, it's probably going to make the next biennium's problem that much greater, sort of thing. So we appreciate, you know, what you're doing. We appreciate the education for us. That was the purpose, the reason I asked you for this presentation. And we understand that, you know, that you are working in within the confines of the governor's balanced budget. There is another budget to come out, and what can happen in that one is dependent upon how much help the one co-chair can get with the powers to be in this building to do something different on it. So, Co-Chair Clinton.
Mr. Chair, I move that the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources seize all federal forest land and management, manage it according to our protocols.
I vote aye.
I didn't hear a second. Was there a second?
I didn't hear a second.
Okay. Thank you all very, very much.
Wanted to thank Representative Schaffler for the love. It's really nice. Feels good.
Thank you. And Northern California sees that, too, while we're at it.
Sure ruined our annexation of Northern California bill, didn't it?
Mr. Chair.
Some strain of
cannabis.
I believe that your message has been received by other members of the other member of the committee to which you were referring.
I was sure it would be, you know, and I appreciate very much the help and cooperation of the other member, and I appreciate all of the folks on this committee that if and when something comes around that you may use your little influence and wherever it is to try to help promote the issue of working on this problem in Oregon forests. I mean, it is a serious problem and one that we can't afford to be negligent or lazy on. So with that, we'll close the informational hearing, and I'm instructed that we're going to go back and reopen the hearing on House Bill 946, and we're going to pass the gavel over to Co-Chair Clem, because I have been summoned to the woodshed in the House Republican Majority Office for some reason.
Ooh. All right.
Peace be with you.
You got,
force be with you.
They're going to be open already. Yeah. Jana and Roger, you want to come up and talk to us about the what was the other one? Something bent grass. What's it called? Hill.
The
Highland Bent Grass Commission and the Oregon Grain Commission and their soon-to-be demise.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record. I'm Jana Jarvis, representing the Oregon Wheat Growers League and today the Oregon Wheat Commission as well. We brought Senate Bill 946 before you today with the purpose of absolving the Oregon Grains Commission and transferring those responsibilities to the Oregon Wheat Commission. Just for a little brief history lesson, I thought I don't know if all of you know this, but the Oregon Wheat Commission was the first commission established in the United States in 1947, and so you can see what happened after that. The commission creates a self-imposed producer tax on each bushel of wheat and grain to fund their efforts. The problem with the Oregon Grains Commission is today there is not enough product being grown to handle the cost, the administrative cost of the commission itself. And so the Grains Commission came to the Wheat Commission and asked them to assume those responsibilities, and that's why we bring Senate Bill 946 before you today. Roger has added on to this bill, and then he wants to talk about that, and then I have an amendment to talk about with you as well. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer here representing the Oregon Seed Council. The Oregon Seed Council is comprised of five different grass seed commodity commissions. One of those commissions, the Oregon Highland Bentgrass Commission, is no longer economically viable. In the handout that you've been received, you see a chart. It looks like this, and no Representative Shoffler, it could be the logging that happens in the state of Oregon, but it is not. Unfortunately, in this case, this is the movement of Highland Bentgrass seed over time. And as you can see, it has fallen from a high of about 10 million pounds per year down to less than 1 million pounds per year. At that level of movement is not enough revenue generated to pay the administration costs of running a commission and perform the one function this commission is vitally important to do, which is to keep the European registration. In order to sell Highland Bentgrass into Europe, it has to be registered in one of the EU countries, European Union countries, every 10 years. And so by dissolving this commission and putting the functions of that commission into the Fine Fescue Commission, hopefully they'll be able to save enough money on administration in order to maintain that European registration so that this valuable crop, it is a valuable crop to those growers who still produce it, but they just don't grow very much of it. And with that, we support the idea of combining these commissions and abolishing the one. We support the emergency clause that Jana is going to speak about, because otherwise the commission would have to start up, operate for 6 months, or continue operating for 6 months, and then shut down in mid-fiscal year. With an emergency clause, they'll be able to not even start next fiscal year, and that just makes more efficient sense. With that, happy to answer any questions, if I could, and I'll let Jana propose the amendment.
Yeah. You have in front of you today, members of the committee, the -2 amendments, which do precisely what Roger just explained to you. It institutes an emergency clause with an effective date of July 1, 2011. With a new fiscal year starting, that will allow these commissions to be dissolved prior to the July 1 date, and so we don't have to run them for a period of time in order to dissolve them, and that's the reason for the -2 amendments. So we would request your support of Senate Bill 946 and your support of the -2 amendments as well. Thank you. Any questions? I'm happy to answer.
Any questions for this panel? Are you certain that Kevin Dorfler doesn't want more time to ride those Italian sports bikes of his? And it's really, this is all a big plot for free time for the chair of the Highland...
What is it?
Highland Bentgrass Commission.
Mr. Chair, I won't speak for Kevin Dorfler, but I do know that every 10 years a delegation has to go to Europe in order to maintain this registration, and I do know that as former chair, once this bill passes, Kevin Dorfler is very interested in making that trip in 2014.
Well, give him our best. Okay, thank you. And we'll wait for the paperwork on the amendment. Probably be on Monday.
Mm-hmm. Monday.
And I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 946A, and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 192. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it? Mike and Bill, you guys want to make your way up here while Beth tells us a little bit about this?
Chair Clem and committee members, Senate Bill 192 requires the State Workforce Investment Board to include in its plan for green job growth an analysis of occupations in the forest products industry to determine key growth factor and employment projections for green jobs in the forest products industry and to determine the educational standards required for current and emerging green job occupations in the forest products industry.
And with that, Mike, you want to go first? I got you first. I don't care, though. Whoever you want. It's always good to have you two here together.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Committee for the record, Bill Clooney, Carpenters Industrial Council. First off, I want to thank Senator Nelson for carrying this bill forward from the Senate side. fill you in real quickly. Senate Bill 192 is exactly House Bill 28 that I want to thank you for passing on the floor yesterday. We just started a bill on both sides. We was advised to bring attention to it from the House and Senate. When we first started looking at this bill a year ago, this came from House Bill 3300 in 2009, which passed, became law. And we looked at this bill, and when we got to looking at all the facts, we got to looking at what jobs were they talking about in the timber industry. And so we couldn't get really an answer on what they classified as what jobs. The workforce development people did their study in 2009. The report was handed in. And we thought by these two simple changes, we wouldn't have to have another complete study. What we did on line 18 was take the word timber out and put in forest products. And then on lines 20, excuse me here, I'll get the right page.
Well, you're looking at that. What was that House bill that we passed yesterday, same bill? What was that number?
2840, Chair. We just classified all the jobs from the landowner to the forest managers to the loggers to the mill workers, the truck drivers, and especially after the last two big paper mill closures, we included paper mills. And we feel that these are all renewable green jobs. And looking back through my records, it was 25 years ago when I and others made our first trip to Washington, D.C. to convince Congress to pass a national forest plan that would benefit and be workable for Oregon. And when I say workable, I mean create Oregon jobs. Well, I'm sorry to say we have not accomplished that. And I made many trips to Washington, D.C. We are still working with our congressional leaders. We have an East Side bill going. I'm also working with BLM, trying to get the West Side going again, especially for the O&C counties. And my intent was with this bill, if we ever get it to the floor of the Congress and the floor of the Senate, and they go to vote, and our congressmen and our senators can stand up there and say, these forest jobs are all green jobs. I know a lot of folks don't like that term, green jobs, but it's a popular term, has been for the last few years. But again, Chair Clem, committee, I feel that when we ever do get up to the floor for a vote, and they can stand up there and say that these are all green jobs, I figure maybe, finally, we'll get a plan that works for Oregon. Thank you.
Hi.
Co-Chair Clem, for the record, my name is Mike Sullivan. I'm the political director in Oregon for the Association of Western Pulp and Paper Workers, and AWPPW is in total support of this. And I'll make my comments brief and just point out what happened to Blue Herring, because I think that's noteworthy. And the most recent, that was 175 AWPPW members that lost their jobs that didn't do anything wrong. Pulp and paper practices in this state are the cleanest in the world. And now China's number one producer of pulp and paper. And what this bill will do for them, hopefully, is they'll get retrained into green jobs when they already had one to begin with. And these employees, union members, have been taxpayers to the state in income, property tax, and now they don't work. And so this isn't a handout. This is a recognition to them that in their time of need, they should get the support of this body. Thank you very much. I will answer any questions.
Questions for these two gentlemen.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Not really a question so much, Mr. Chair, but just, again, comments. I think you're preaching to the choir in regards to some of us here, but, you know, it just seems so ironic that we have to insert this kind of language in here, you know, and that they, whatever color we want to call them, the only green that people are looking for in regards to job is the green that's in their wallet. You know, job that pays a paycheck and produces income is the green that most Oregonians are looking for. But again, without policies that enable a natural resource development, again, these are just words on paper. And that's where we have to go, is to enact some policies that will allow us to use our natural resources that will produce jobs for Oregonians and worthwhile products for the world and you know, around the globe. So anyway, just a comment. So I appreciate what you're doing, and I think it's a good idea.
I'm going to take that as a second on my motion to seize all federal forest lands and manage them.
Absolutely.
Under our control, this committee particularly.
Can I co-sponsor that, Mr. Chair?
That motion, sure. The other chair is not here right now. Let's pass it. Let's see what Ramona says. What do you think?
No? Okay. We can hand in grocery, can't we?
Any further questions? Yeah, we'll just write it ourselves right now.
Mr.
Chair? To D.C.
Yes. It would die in the Environment Committee and Senate, so it's an exercise of futility.
This will just be our little effort. The House Committee.
I vote yes.
Yes. Okay. Sorry. Any further questions for these two fine gentlemen? Representative Escobar.
I don't have a question, but I just want to say that I really appreciate both of what you both do, because we've been working now together for 6-7 years, and you know, we all have the same cause, we have the same goals, and you know, by golly, one of these days maybe we'll make her.
I'd be optimistic.
Thank you.
Okay. Anything else? Okay.
I'm gonna. What we. One question.
Can we work this?
Given this other bill going through, do you have a preference on what exactly, which bill we make law? It passed the House already. Obviously, this has passed the Senate already.
Sure, Clem. I figured since Senator Courtney signed on the Senate side, and the co-speakers between the three of them, they could decide which one. We have no preference.
All right, well, let me try and sort it out before someone gets mad at me for killing their bill.
We're done.
Not if they've already decided the other one's the one to do. I got to figure out. We don't want to put two bills on the governor's desk.
Exactly. So we were told, Chair Lim, to start two bills and work them through.
It's like $1,000 for LC to write. Yeah. No meeting on Friday. Well, let me close the public hearing on Senate Bill 192. Announcements, no meeting on Friday. With that, anything else for to go to the order? Adjourned.